Good evening. Happy New Year to you. My name is Rob Shepherd. I'm the lead pastor at Next Level Church, and I really am excited for you guys to be here. I wanted to add on to one thing that you just heard in the 60-second update, and that is about our groups. Next Level groups are, if you're new around here, they are the best way to get connected and to meet other people, and we do them by semester. And so a new semester is getting ready to kick off at the end of this month, and the deadline to sign up for a group is a week from this Sunday, so next Sunday. But here's the deal that you need to know. Our groups fill up really fast. And so if you're interested in a group, do not wait till next Sunday to sign up, because already there are two groups out of our six that are full. And so if you find a group, sign up quickly, because they are filling up. And there's more groups that are almost full, so sign up quickly. The other thing I want to say about our groups is our groups are not based off of stage of life or age or location. They're based off of what's going to help take you to the next level spiritually. And so we have a menu. It's in your seat. It gives a description of all the groups. You can also read a description online. But the idea is that you would pick a group that's going to help challenge you and take you to the next level. And we've heard from a few people that last semester they had to drive a long ways to get to some of these groups. And so we've tried to do our best to make the groups a little bit closer to where the church is located. So right now, I believe the furthest group is located in the Kiln Creek area, we have one in Pocosin. And so we've tried to keep them within about 15 minutes drive from here, so that hopefully you're not driving an hour to get to the location. So try not to worry about location. Try to pick a group based off what's going to help take you to the next level, and that's all I have to say about groups. Well, tonight we're kicking off a brand new series entitled Seven Sins That Will Kill You Dead. Sounds fun, right? This is actually a series that I think is really important to us, and what inspired me to do this series to kick off the new year was an article I read, and it talked about some things, especially about the culture of Christianity in America today. And Christianity today, what we're experiencing, is a result of two different movements. In the early 19th century, and for years, there was a movement called the Holiness Movement. And the Holiness Movement spurred out of this desire to help Christians actually live godly lives. And the church at that time was looking around and was seeing that there were people coming to church, but their lives didn't look like Jesus. And so they were coming out and saying, we've got to do better. And so what they did is they started raising the bar, and they started saying not just certain things are sin, but certain things that might lead you to sin are sin. And it was through the Holiness Movement that people started saying things like even a sip of alcohol is a sin. Even though the Bible doesn't say that, they came up and said, hey, alcohol can lead to crazy things. And so even sniffing it, even looking at it is a sin. Stay away from it. And through this, though, it led to a whole bunch of extra biblical ideas. Through this came the idea that movies are sin. Because there's worldly stuff that happens in movies. So if you're a Christian, you can't see any movie. It doesn't matter what the rate. Stay away from movies. And out of this movement came this idea that rock and roll was bad. And rock and roll had drums. And so because rock and roll had drums, drums had no place in the church. And they actually taught and believed that drums in the church was sin. It was all this extra legalistic junk. And it came out of a great place trying to help Christians actually live a better life for God. But what ended up happening is people that came out of the Holiness Movement ended up becoming legalistic jerks. And they started judging other people and saying, oh, you go to movies? Well, you must not love God like I love God. Oh, you have some alcohol in your house? You don't love God like I love God. Oh, you like rock and roll? You're a pagan. You're going to fry like bacon. Like people challenged other people. They said things were sin that weren't even sins. They said these extra things were sin, and it came out of a good place. But there was a response to the Holiness Movement, and it came in the 1960s. In the 1960s, we were introduced to what is known as the Jesus Movement. And the Jesus Movement was a group of hippies who had responded and said, you know what? I don't think God cares about the length of our hair. And you're telling me I'm going to hell because I have a haircut like the Beatles, but I don't think that jives with the God that I read about in the Bible. And so this Jesus Movement came on the scene, and they started preaching grace. And they started saying, no, it's not about the works that you do. It's not about avoiding movies. It's not about avoiding everything completely. It's about grace. I am saved by grace. And I personally am a huge fan of grace. I think that's a great thing. But the problem is that the Jesus Movement swept through the church so strong, and what intended to be a good thing has now developed to this idea that many Christians say. And the idea is simply, I can do whatever I want because of God's grace. And it's this idea that, yep, I'm saved by grace. So it doesn't matter if I have huge sins in my life. It doesn't matter what I watch. It doesn't matter what I listen to. It doesn't matter what words come out of my mouth, because I'm a sinner, you're a sinner. We're all saved by grace. And this is where phrases came out like all sin is sin. I don't know if you ever heard that phrase, or it's this idea that in the eyes of God, sin is sin. Like, your sin is no more worse than my sin. We're all sinners. And I agree with that, but there's a little bit of a problem. The Bible doesn't describe sin that way. In fact, when the Bible talks about sin, it does make sure that we know that any sin is enough to cause Jesus to die for us. So whether it's a little white lie or it's murder, that is enough to cause God to send His Son to die on a cross for us. Like, sin is bad. Sin is separates us from God. And that's where we get the idea that sin is sin. But then the Bible comes along and is clear that, yep, okay, all sin separates us from God, but there are different consequences to sin. And if someone asks you how much you weigh, and you tell them that you weigh 5 pounds less than you really do, that is a sin. It's bad. But the consequences of that is very different than if you murder someone. And so to say that sin is sin is kind of a half-truth. Because yes, sin is sin in the sense that God doesn't love us any less if we tell white lies or if we murder someone. God loves us not based off what we do, but based off the fact that we're His kids. But there are different consequences to sin. And so this grace movement has come out and it's developed a culture of people who say, you know what, it doesn't matter what I do. I don't have to worry about legalism. I don't have to worry about this holiness junk. I am saved by grace. And I think that the church is not supposed to be on one of these extremes. I think we're supposed to be somewhere in the middle. That we are supposed to be defined by the holiness of God. At the same time, we're defined by God's grace. Because the Bible says this kind of thing over and over again. In fact, look at it with me. It says, "But just as He who called you is holy, so be holy in all you do. For it is written, 'Be holy because I am holy.'" This is a verse that you can find multiple places in the Bible. And the challenge is that if you're here today and you would say that you are a Christian, that God has called you out of your sin, that you are one of God's people, the challenge for you is that you are called to be holy. Why? Because you're called to represent God in the world, and God is holy. So if you know God, you're going to live a life that is holy. So that is where the holiness movement got it right. But where they got it wrong is that they started saying, well, then you can't have any fun, and they became a legalistic jerk that was just all about the rules, because they forgot that the Bible also comes around and says, "For sin shall no longer be your master, because you are not under the law, but under grace." We are to be people that represent God in a holy way, but we're not defined by what we do. We're defined by God's grace. So I read this article that really made me feel like there's something that we as a church need to know. In fact, I think there's something out there that can help us balance this idea of being holy because God is holy, but at the same time being a people of grace. And the article was about the 7 deadly sins. Now, I didn't grow up Catholic, so I had never heard of the 7 deadly sins until 1996 when Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman made a movie called 7. Anyone seen that movie? Okay, this is not an endorsement. That movie freaked me out. It is a freaky, scary movie. And I went to the theater as a senior in high school with a group of friends, and we saw 7, and they kept talking about the Bible and these 7 deadly sins. I had no idea about any of it, and I was like, man, this is scary. This is freaky stuff. But I had never done any research on the 7 deadly sins. I just accepted it for what it was. But I read this article recently that talked about the main idea of the 7 deadly sins and why they were given to our culture. And the 7 deadly sins started in various ways, and there's various starts, and various people kind of came up with the idea of it. But Pope Gregory is the one that kind of put the name to the 7 deadly sins. And the reason that he came up with these 7 deadly sins was very fascinating to me. It was twofold. Number one, he came up with the 7 deadly sins to help his people remember the Bible. And you got to understand, he was preaching in a day and age that they didn't have the printing press. No one had copies of the Bible themselves. In fact, most people were illiterate. And so he was preaching sermons and saying, I've got to get this Bible into people's hands. I've got to get it so where they're not just listening to it on Sunday, but they're thinking about it Monday through Sunday. And so he came up with this idea of the 7 deadly sins. Now, if you look in your Bible, you're never going to find a list of the 7 deadly sins. That wording is not in the Bible. But the idea of him was not to rewrite the Bible or to come up with something the Bible didn't say. The idea for him was to come up with 7 big things that lead to all other sins. And specifically, he wanted people to remember it throughout the week, but he wanted them to not just remember it and know the knowledge, he wanted them to do some reflection. And the idea of the seven deadly sins was that people would start to look inward and say, hey, how am I doing with my relationship with God? Are there things in my life that maybe aren't reflecting God? Even though I'm going to church, even though I might be serving some people, even though I'm a nice person, are there things that are pointing in my heart that are sin? And when I read that, I thought, man, that is something that our church needs to know about. We need to know about sin. We need to talk about sin, but we also need to understand that we're under God's grace. And I think that the seven deadly sins are going to help us do that. And so to kick off this first talk in this series, I wanted to jump into the middle of the seven deadly sins. And I personally like the middle because I'm a middle child, and I think the middle gets overlooked often. Any middle children feel my pain? That's a proper time to say amen. You can say amen to that. All you middle children who suffered through life having an older sibling and a younger sibling, it is awful to be a middle child. In fact, I just want us to set up a new year's resolution. Any of you young parents who are having kids, we need to put an end to middle children. If you have two kids and you're going to have a third, you might as well jump up and get a fourth. Do not create any middle children anymore. One is good, two is good, three, four, great. I'm telling you, talk to a middle child. It is awful. Middle children are overlooked. Middle children are misunderstood. And in the middle of this list of the seven deadly sins is a middle child that has been completely misunderstood. And the middle seven deadly sin is the word sloth. And today, when people talk about the seven deadly sin, they said that it means laziness. And the word laziness doesn't really resonate with me. I mean, I get that we shouldn't be lazy, but I don't know a lot of verses that really help inspire me to be more like God that talk about laziness. But in this article that I read, it said that the original intent of sloth was not just saying don't be lazy. It was this word, acedia. And acedia means apathy. The original idea was in the middle of these seven deadly sins to help Christians who were illiterate, who didn't know the Bible, to remember that one sin that will lead to a whole bunch of other sins is acedia. And it's not laziness, it's apathy. Now, apathy is a word that we are more familiar with, but in case you're not really familiar with it, the definition of apathy is simply a lack of interest, enthusiasm, or concern. And the original idea of the seven deadly sins was not just a lack of interest, enthusiasm, or concern for the world, but a spiritual lack of interest, a spiritual lack of enthusiasm, and a spiritual lack of concern. So when it comes to the matters of God, it was church people who were not interested in God. And it was church people who were not enthusiastic for God. And it was church people who came to church on a regular basis, but they had no concern for the things that God was concerned about. That was spiritual apathy. That's what acedia means. And that was one of the seven deadly sins, the one that fell right in the middle. Now, acedia, this idea, sloth, it's this picture of having something amazing happen to you and responding like it's everyday news. It's saying, oh, this is an amazing thing. This is a mind-blowing thing. This is something that doesn't happen to everyone. Ho-hum, I've experienced greatness. And I don't know if you've ever met someone or have a friend in your life who constantly tells you amazing things in a dead-tone voice, but it drives me crazy. I have a friend, his name is Matt, and he has the most amazing stories ever. Every time I meet with him, he tells me this story that if I didn't know him personally, I would call him to his face a liar. These are just these amazing, just crazy stories. And every time he tells them to me, he just says it deadpan in a monotone voice, and he always adds this phrase to it. You know what I'm saying, Rob? And every time he tells me a story, I'm like, no, I don't. I've never experienced what you just said. A few years ago, we were at his house in Richmond, and we were sitting around their kitchen table, and on the refrigerator, there was a hand-drawn picture of a guy laying on a bed, and he had squirrels all around him. And we had been sitting there for a couple hours talking, and I kept looking at that picture, and I just kept wondering, what in the world? That is the weirdest picture I've ever seen. So I just asked him, I said, Matt, you got to explain this picture. And he's like, oh, you know, something happened to me. I told this story to my wife's kindergarten class, and one of the kids drew a picture. You know how it is, Rob. No, I don't. I have no idea. I've never had a kid draw a picture based off of one of my stories. What the heck happened in that story? And he goes on to tell me that he was looking for a job, and he opened up the newspaper, and in the newspaper was a classified ad for someone that could do pest control, specifically animal pest control. So if you had a skunk or a raccoon or a squirrel that was in your house or around your house you need taken care of, you would call this company. And so he calls them and they interview him. And when they interview him, they simply asked him, do you feel comfortable catching animals? And he said, yep, I grew up in Farmville, Virginia. It is a real place, not just a video game. And I'm a hunter. I'm a fisherman. I feel comfortable catching animals. They said, okay, you got the job. And so then they said, here's what you do. You don't come into an office. You just wait at your phone. And when we have a pest problem, we'll call you and you go take care of it. Now, I stopped him right there and I started asking questions. I said, Matt, they didn't give you any training? And he said, no. I said, they didn't give you any equipment, like any like claw things or gloves or something? He's like, no, they just told me they were going to call me. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. And he said that he waited by the phone and he got a phone call one day. And the phone call said, all right, we have something for you. Do you feel comfortable catching squirrels? And he said, oh, yeah, no problem. I've caught squirrels before, no big deal. And he said, okay, well, there is an attic in a suburban neighborhood in Richmond, Virginia, that is infested with squirrels, and we need you to go clean them out. He said, okay. So he shows up to this person's house, and he has no uniform on. He has no name tag. He has nothing official. He shows up in regular clothes, and he says, I'm here from this company to take care of your squirrel problem. So the lady leads him up to the attic, and he says, when I got to the attic, he was like, Rob, it was madness. He said, there were squirrels everywhere. There was mama squirrels and daddy squirrels and baby squirrels. There were just dozens of squirrels. You know how it is? No, I don't, Matt. This is the craziest thing I've ever heard. And I was like, Matt, what did you do? And he said, well, I reached out and I grabbed a squirrel with my bare hand. And I said, no, you did not. I was like, Matt, squirrels are really quick. There's no way you grabbed a squirrel. And he's like, no, Rob, you know how it is. Like when there's dozens of squirrels all around, they were running everywhere. They were running over my feet. They were running all over the walls. They were running everywhere. And there were so many squirrels, it was easy. I just picked up a squirrel with my bare hand. And I was like, well, what happened next? And he said, well, squirrel, when you catch it with your bare hands, it starts biting and clawing you. You know how it is. No, I don't. This is the most crazy story I've ever heard. And this squirrel starts biting him and clawing him, and it freaks him out. And so he takes a step back, and he ends up falling through the ceiling of this person's house. And he is holding on to the attic of the boards, and he's got feet dangling, and he's like, you know how it is, Rob? No! I've seen this in movies. This is the craziest thing ever. And I was like, Matt, what did you do? And I'm excited, and he's just like, this is a normal story. And he said, well, I tried to pull myself up, but I wasn't strong enough, and so I just let myself through. And luckily, I was in the woman's bedroom, and I landed on her bed. And he was like, but Rob, you got to understand that now there was a hole in the ceiling. And there were squirrels everywhere, so it started raining squirrels on me. You know how it is, Rob? No! This is the most unbelievable story ever, and you told it to me like you went out and got the mail. I've seen people make money rain. I've never seen squirrels rain. This is an unbelievable story. And you got to get some excitement in you, because this kind of thing does not happen to anyone else. And he has dozens of stories like that, and he just tells it with a deadpan, like everyday business, this is a normal thing. And it reminds me so much of Christians today. I'm a lost sinner. I was separated from God, but the God of the universe loved me so much that he sent his son to die for me. And now I have a relationship with God. Ho-hum, no big deal. And the God of the universe, who can't stand sin, overlooked my sin, and now he's living in my heart. Oh, man, I've been a Christian for years. No big deal. And we've taken the amazingness of the God of the universe and we've turned it into a ho-hum statement like we're going to get the mail. That's apathy. Don't you ever get over what God has done for you. The God of the universe loves you unconditionally. And he doesn't love you based off your performance. He loves you because you're his kid. How can you not get excited about that? And yet so many Christians today are just like, ho-hum, yep, I got God. I go to church, break every chain, just going to go through the motions. But I think if you're a Christian, then God is trying to pull you out of apathy. You should be excited about what God, not just what he did in the past, but what he's currently doing in your life. So I want to ask you some questions to wrap your mind around whether or not you're spiritually apathetic. Do you feel a hunger for God? Do you feel a hunger for God? And I'm not talking about at one point in your life. I'm talking about right now, currently. Do you feel a hunger for God? Is there something inside of you that is the exact same feeling as when you haven't eaten a couple meals? You say, man, I'm hungry. I've got to get some food. Is there something inside of you that's like, I just got to get in God's presence. I got to experience him. If you think that just church is ho-hum and just reading the Bible is ho-hum and just something that you get to do, there's a great chance that you're apathetic, because we should feel this sense of, man, God, I just slept for 6 hours. I just slept for 8 hours. It's been a while since I talked to you. Good morning, God. What's going on? God, man, it's been a whole week since I was with your people in church. I can't wait to get to church on Sunday. God, I went through a whole work day, and I spent a lot of time thinking about me and my problems. I can't wait to get into the Bible and just read it and just to spend time with you. But for so many Christians, they signed up on the dotted line, they got their ticket to heaven, and so they're good, so they no longer have a hunger for God. And if you don't have a hunger for God, it could be a sign that you're spiritually apathetic. Do you feel a desire to know God more? Do you feel a desire to know God more? When you really get to know someone, you stop asking them questions. I've been married to my wife for 12 years, and we don't ask each other a lot of questions because we're very familiar with each other. But when you first get to know someone, you ask them tons of questions. What's your favorite color? What was your first car? You're interested in them. And far too many Christians have said, oh, I've been doing this thing for a few years. I've been going to church for 4 or 5 years. I got God figured out. I don't have a need to get to know God anymore. But I want to tell you that God's not dead. God is a living, active being, and he's a God that is so big, our brains can't even wrap around him. So we can't sit there and say, yep, I got to know God. I know him. I know everything about him. No, you don't know God. And you should have a desire to get to know God more. God, what do you care about? God, I said I'm a Christian. Well, what does that mean? God, what are you asking me to do? I just want to know you more. I want to be in your presence. I want to know what you love. I want to know what you hate. I want to be with you. Do you care about what God cares about? Do you care about what God cares about? Now, God cares about a lot of stuff, and I honestly believe that not all of us are cared to passionately care about everything that God cares about. But there should be at least one thing in your life that is just stirring you to say, man, the only reason I care about this is because God cares about it. And I may not care about everything that God cares about with a passion, but there should be one thing in your life that is just saying, man, God, it breaks God's heart when this happens, and he is stirring me to do something about it. Do you care about what God cares about? Last question is, are you content with where you are spiritually? Are you content with where you are spiritually? One of the biggest signs of apathy is when people say, I'm good. I know the answers. I've heard this sermon before. I can tell you everything that God wants us to do. Are you content? Do you sit in Sunday sermons and nod your head and say, yep, I know where this is going. I've heard this one before. I said the prayer. I've done the deal. Or are you constantly saying, man, I'm so far from God. Thank God for God's grace. God, I got a long way to go. Thanks for putting up with me. Are you content with where you are spiritually? Well, this idea of spiritual apathy is something that drove Jesus crazy, because there were a lot of religious leaders in Jesus' day that were all about the rules and the regulations, but they weren't about a relationship. And so Jesus constantly was challenging their thought process. And one time, this guy of the law, this guy who really knew the Bible, approaches Jesus, and we have this amazing story that is against apathy. It's going to come on the screens for you. I want you to follow along with me. He says, on one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. Teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus was a master. Whenever he was asked a question, he often threw back another question, and he said, what is written in the law? How do you read it? Well, the guy answered, this master of the law, he said, well, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. And then Jesus says, you've answered correctly. Do this and you will live. Well, if you want to sum up the entire Bible, the Old Testament and the New Testament, it can be summed up with this phrase, love God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul, and love your neighbor like you love yourself. And a lot of times in our culture, people like to nitpick and find these very controversial verses that are about things and say, no, look, God's not a God of love, and there's all these like questionable, scary things in the Bible, and a lot of people like to focus on them. But I want to say the main theme, the thing that runs through the whole Bible, is a God of love, and that you are called, if you're a Christian, if you're a follower of him, you are called to love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. It's like all your being. It's this sense of like, I can't get over you. I can't get tired of being in your presence. I am madly in love with God. And when you do that, then it spurs something inside of you, and all of a sudden you start to care about your neighbor. You care about other people. And so the guy answers the question correctly. In fact, when Jesus was asked this question again, he said the exact same answer. So Jesus is looking at the guy and he says, "Survey says," that's the number one answer. "You nailed it, buddy. This is great." But then the conversation keeps going. And the guy, let's look at what happens next. But he wanted to justify himself. So he asked Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" So this religious guy of the law gives the right answer. But then when Jesus says, "You nailed it," he wasn't content with saying, "Oh, thank you." He then wanted to justify his actions. Another way of saying this is, he was doing the bare minimum and wanted to make sure that was okay. And he was saying, "Hey, I followed all the law. I've heard all the teachings. I've done the deal. I go to church. Is that good enough, Jesus?" And Jesus hears this guy's question, and he goes into story mode. He tells a parable. Let's look at what he says next. He says, in reply, Jesus said, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead." Now, I want to stop there just for a second. Jesus is talking to this audience, and he's telling them some things that are starting to scream, "You are not to be apathetic." In fact, the guy that asked the question, you've asked this question, and you're trying to justify your behavior. But I want to introduce you to some characters. First off, there's this character that is a priest. And the priest was considered like the top dog. It would be like the Pope of today. And you had to be born of a certain family to be a priest. And only the priest, the head priest, were allowed into the Holy of Holies where God was. And he says, so there's this priest and there's a Levite. Well, the Levite is a little bit lower than the priest, but he still has these amazing job description. He is one that's supposed to take care of the temple. And you have to be born of a certain bloodline in order to be a Levite. And this guy is trying to justify his behavior. And I think that Jesus is speaking to him, and he's saying a few things. And I think these are some things that we need to be saying to ourselves. Number one, God's people neglect to do God's work. In this story, this guy is doing all the religious stuff, and Jesus is telling a story about a Levite and a priest who are doing all the religious stuff. But when God's people neglect to do God's work, it is a sign of apathy. And in the story, Jesus is talking about this Levite and this priest, and they meet someone. They meet someone who has been robbed, and they don't care about it. They neglect to do God's work. Another sign of apathy is God's people are content not doing God's work. God's people are content not doing God's work. So in the story, you need to make sure that you get this, because Jesus is speaking into this guy's life, and he's saying, "Hey, you are trying to justify your actions. Let me tell you what apathy is. Apathy is when God's people neglect to do God's work. But number two, it's when God's people are content not doing God's work." And so it's not just that they say, "Oh yeah, we should be doing something good." It's that they say, "You know what, I don't really care. I'm good to go. I got my ticket to heaven, so I don't need to do what God has called me to do." And number three, God's people make excuses for not doing God's work. So this man is trying to justify his behavior, and Jesus says, "Hey, I want you to picture something. You are this Levite. You are this priest. You are justifying your behavior. You're the ones in this story." And watch what happens next. He says, let's go back to that verse. In reply, Jesus said, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed on the other side." So now that you understand what the Levite and the priest is, you understand why this would be a story that would grab Jesus' audience attention. The two religious people, the heroes of the day, the two highest people in the religious system, see a guy who has been beat half to death, and he is naked, and he's sitting in a ditch, and instead of saying, "Hey, we should do something about it," they go to the other side of the road, and they ignore him. And Jesus is saying, hey, buddy, the one that's trying to justify your behavior, this is you. This is you. Now, if you understand the culture that Jesus lived in, then you know that there was actually a good reason why a Levite and a priest wouldn't go and help this half-dead guy. Because in their culture, if a Levite or a priest touched a dead body, they would have been considered unclean. And if you get considered unclean, if you touch something that's dead, you actually had to go back to where you just came from the temple, and you had to present yourself, and it was this whole ordeal, and it was a very embarrassing thing. Now, everyone in Jesus' audience would have known that. We don't know that because we're not familiar with Jewish culture, but essentially Jesus is saying, hey, the reason that the Levite and priest are in the wrong here is because they're more concerned with themselves than they are about what God wants them to do. And they're walking along and they're saying, I'm good to go with God. I just went to a church service. I'm a Levite. I'm a priest. I'm a Christian. I've signed on the dotted line. I'm doing what I'm supposed to be. Ho-hum. Oh, there's someone that needs help? Well, that's going to cost me something. Oh, well, people might say that I'm a friend of sinners. People might judge me if I hang out with them. I might become unclean. And so they ignored someone that was half dead and they justified their behavior because they said, I'm a Levite and I'm a priest. Jesus is like, oh, come on, man, this is wrong. Yeah, you signed up on the dotted line. Yep, you go to church, but like, aren't human beings important? And how dare you say, yeah, I'm a Christian, but then ignore the needs of people? Spiritual apathy says, I've got what I need. I don't have to care about anyone else. I'm good to go. I'm a priest. I'm a Levite. I'm a Christian. Oh, yeah, I know you don't know God. Psh, I don't care. I know your world's falling apart, but it would take a lot of time if I started messing and talking to you and getting to know you, and it's just not worth it to me, so I'm just going to sit here and relax and go to my church services and act like everything's okay. Well, Jesus then goes on to the story, and this is where it gets really controversial. He says, but a Samaritan. Now, the priest and the Levite are supposed to be the heroes of the story, and they end up being the bad guys, and a Samaritan was the bad guy of Jesus' day. A Samaritan is what was known as a half-breed. That meant that one of their parents was a Jew and the other parent was not. And it was a huge insult. In fact, one time some religious leaders get really mad at Jesus and they say, you are filled with the devil. Aren't you demon-possessed? You Samaritan. And so they insult Jesus by calling him a Samaritan. So in Jesus' audience, when they hear Samaritan, they think, okay, surely this is going to be the bad guy of the story. But Jesus says, but a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring an oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. Look after him, he said, and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have. So in the story, the religious leaders, the ones that are supposed to be caring about God's people, ignore a need and go to the other side of the road. And a Samaritan, who is supposed to be the bad guy of the story, says, hey, I don't care if this is going to make me unclean. And this guy's half dead, so it's going to cost me something. Here, I'm going to put you on my donkey, because it's not about me. And yet, this is going to make me unclean, and I'm going to have to go back to the temple and ask for forgiveness, but I don't care. You have a need, and I can meet that need. And it's going to cost me something. Here's 2 denarii. I'm going to take you to a hotel, to a hospital, to a place that can meet your needs. Here's my own money. In fact, I want you to run a tab. Help this guy out, whatever he needs, whatever food, whatever clothes, anything this guy needs. You charge me. This is costing me something. And even though I don't know this joker, God has called me to care for people that need me. So I'm going to reach out. And the question in this story, the thing that Jesus is screaming is, you know who the guy's neighbor was? The neighbor was the Levite or the priest because it was a Jew. You know who was not the neighbor? The Samaritan. He wasn't from around there. And Jesus was saying, hey, you know what? I know you're a Christian. I know you said a prayer one time. I know you signed up on the dotted line. But I didn't call you to just sit there happily with your Jesus and say, one day I'm going to heaven. I've called you to make a difference in the world. And if you are going to be one of my followers, then you are to be like the Samaritan and not like the religious leaders. Jesus goes on to say, which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? The expert in the law replied, the one who had mercy on him. Jesus told him, go and do likewise. But in essence, the point of this story is that Jesus told them, do not be like the religious leaders. Even though they follow every law, even though they look really godly, even though they do more religious stuff than anyone else, even though they're very busy spiritually, do not be like them. Because their religion is all about them. And they're more concerned with how they look and what they do. And they're not concerned with what I'm trying to do in this world. Don't be like them. Be like the dirty Samaritan who, yes, he loves God. Yes, he's going to honor God, but he is not slothful. He is not lazy. He is not more concerned with how he looks. He is concerned with God and obeying God. And if that means meeting people's needs and getting his hands dirty, that's what he's going to do. The application for tonight is simply this. The key to avoiding sloth is not the proper level of activity, but the proper attitude of the heart. You see, the reason that it's a problem to say that sloth is laziness is that makes Christians think that they just got to get busy and we just got to do stuff and we need more programs and we need to just be serving at the church all the time. But that's not this idea of sloth. The idea of sloth is meeting people's needs. And if there's someone who is spiritually starving and you know them, you are called to be the Samaritan and to meet their needs. And so the key, the application to avoiding sloth is not just to sign up for more church programs, is not just to do more stuff, it's to change your heart. Because these seven deadly sins were not meant to just make us feel bad, they were make us to do some reflection. And if you don't care about your neighbor, if you're not even asking the question, who is my neighbor, it is a sign that you are spiritually apathetic. And Jesus would say, hey, I don't want you just to get busy, I want you to just start praying and say, hey, change my heart, there's something wrong with me. I've signed up on the dotted line, and I don't give a rip where people go. I've signed up on the dotted line, and there's people hurting all around me, and I'm too busy with myself, with my own religion, with doing my own thing. And Jesus is speaking into them, saying, no. If you're going to be one of my followers, you're going to care about your neighbor. You're going to reach out into the dirty places and the people that don't know me. And if you don't have a desire to follow God, if you are spiritually apathetic, it is a sign of your heart, not a sign of your busyness. So this month, we kicked off a new campaign for our Make a Difference, and it's called Who is Your One? And the idea is that there are lots of needs in this world, and there are lots of things that we could be doing, but what if we just focused on one person? What if we just said, who is my neighbor? Who is one person that I could make a difference for? Who is one person that's struggling? Who's one person that's hurting in this world? You can be the person that makes a difference in their life. In fact, I think that the world is looking for Christians to do something, to make some type of difference. I met with a pastor friend today that was telling me this story that he got an email from someone that goes to his church, and the person was questioning God and saying, hey, where is God? And the scenario that led them to question God was a horrific story, and I wish I didn't even hear it. But the story was that this person had a friend who had allowed her boyfriend to rape her infant. And they were heartbroken. And they said, I don't understand. I thought you said God loved us. Where was God? Why was God silent? Why was God not breaking through and taking that guy and just getting rid of him? That is awful. Where is God? And I want you to know, I don't have answers to where God is. There are no simple, easy answers. But I do know that God has called His people to be the hands and feet of God. And so often, God becomes our scapegoat. Where is God? I want to know, where are the Christians? Because we're sitting here safe in our churches while there is crap like that going on in the world. And I know you've experienced it. I know that you've seen it. And I know that maybe your neighbor is doing all sorts of things that is just crazy. But I would just say, if you are a Christian, you are called to be a light of the world. And how dare we sit back and say, oh God, you take care of that. No, He's called you to take care of it. Spiritual apathy says, no, I'm okay. You're okay. I got Jesus. I'm good to go. But I would say that God is calling us to something greater. And He's calling us to reach out. And so who is your one? Who's your neighbor? Who do you know that doesn't want to have anything to do with God? Who's your family member that says, don't ever talk to me about Jesus? Who's your coworker that says, don't you ever invite me to church? Who's the person whose life is least reflecting to God? Start praying for that person. Start investing in them. Start making a difference. You be the good Samaritan to someone. You find someone and make a difference in them. Don't be spiritually apathetic. To close, what I want to do is I want to give you a chance to simply reflect and to just ask God what you need to do. And for some of you, maybe it's just simply saying, God, who is my one? Who is the person that I need to make a difference for? For others of you, maybe it's saying, God, I'm really sorry. I'm sorry that I've made Christianity all about myself and my needs, and I haven't asked what you want me to do. But however you are called to respond, whatever you think God might be saying to you, I want to give you a few moments just to sit in silence and just talk to God. Just simply say, God, hey, I'm sorry. Or God, hey, who is my one? Who is the person that you've called me to reach? Who is my neighbor? So I'm going to give you a chance to talk to God, and then we'll end with worship. Bow your heads and pray.